delighted to be here and to address this group. I will tell you that I have been in this building before. In fact, I'm going to date myself because I was here when Hyman was here, and I gave remarks to in this building in 1992, and it was on a topic not dissimilar to this. And afterwards, Hyman came up to me and said, "Well, you had part of it right and part of it wrong." And I said, "Well, that's the story of my life, so thank you," which is probably the case today as well as I talk about the banking industry structure and so forth. Now, I have made a proposal. It's been out now since March 13th. I have copies of it. I'm not going to give that proposal again to you, but I'm going to try and give background to why I thought we should have that proposal for discussion in the emerging, I guess I'll call it areas of research that go forward from here with the banking structure of the United States that's become so important. And it follows, if I can say, you know, in this country, for most of our history, up until literally the late 90s, the American banking industry was comprised of numerous firms with a range of specialties and sizes, but all with a similar business model of intermediation from deposits into loans or something close to loans. During that period, I think the industry was very competitive, obviously, with assets nearly evenly distributed among three groups: the money center banks, the regional banks, and the, what we refer to as the community banks, about a third, a third, and a third. It was a very robust system, had its issues. And more recently, though, the forces of change have dramatically transformed that structure. I think we all recognize that. Now the largest banks are disproportionately larger, and their activities, in many instances, differ from their smaller counterparts. In broad terms, I would say that the banking industry and how it meets the needs of businesses and individuals has really been reshaped and is constantly changing forward. So what I want to do this morning is outline my observations of the forces in play, discuss what they imply for the industry, and speculate, and I will admit right up front, is speculate on what this might mean for the future of the industry in the United States. So let me start very quickly with the forces of change, and I'm going to name four. One is obvious: technology and financial engineering. I mean, that's changed much of how banking is done in terms of gathering the funding, metadata or megadata systems that have commoditized credit are really a force that has encouraged scale as we go forward. And I think that has had an important effect. The second factor is legislation, and I'll name two pieces before I talk about Dodd-Frank that I think helped shape the industry as it moved into the 21st century. And that's the Regal-Neal Interstate Banking, which opened up the boundaries across the United States that therefore allowed for consolidation at an incredibly rapid pace across the country, because you got rid of those barriers cross-border, statewide and nationwide. And the other, of course, was Graham-Leach-Bliley, which also opened up the markets, allowed the commercial banks to engage in investment broker-dealer activities within the safety net, and this changed the dynamics between the commercial banking industry and the investment banking industry pretty dramatically. The other around that, then, was another force was the nature of ownership of the structure of some parts of the corporation, of financial corporations, primarily investment banks that were partnerships and then became corporate formed and, of course, then began to merge with the commercial banking industry, which also changed the culture generally within the financial, but particularly within the commercial banking industry, because you took that trading mentality and you brought it into commercial banking, and the dynamics did change, I think, the industry important ways and in how they looked at risk and accepted risk. The final, but I think in some ways the more immediate and in dramatic force was the financial crisis itself. I think its effects and the government's response to that altered the industry structure and direction in ways that I think have dramatically changed and will continue to change the industry in the future. In coping with the crisis, for example, though we saw consolidation, but in coping with the crisis, we did see J.P. Morgan Chase acquire Bear Stearns, Washington Mutual, and bulk up. We saw Bank of America acquire IndyMac and Merrill Lynch and larger. We saw a change in the investment banks that did remain independent, Goldman and Morgan Stanley. They became bank-holding companies so they could get access to the safety net, which changed the dynamics of those firms as well, as we see today. So this significant consolidation has occurred in the rest of the industry as well at the same time. So it wasn't just there, it was elsewhere. There were over 500 bank failures that were taken into receivership and resold by the FDIC into other companies. And there were almost 1,600 private mergers of banks between 2009 and 2014. So even at the middle and lower areas, the consolidation movement only accelerated in response, in part, to that crisis and these other forces that I talked about. So what's the post-crisis industry and its implications might look like? Well, certainly the landscape, as I've said, of banking America has been altered. How much? Well, let's just give it some perspective. In 1992, the four largest U.S. banks held roughly 14% of total assets, while the remainder of the industry had the 86%. Now, the four largest have over 40%, and the remainder of the industry has less than 60%. So that's just the four largest. If you take the 20 largest, that number becomes quite dramatically greater, almost double, in terms of the share. So we've had, I think, a fairly clear indication of the consolidation. And I might add that those four largest now have $7 trillion in assets, which is almost 40% of U.S. GDP. So they're now you see why they are systemic almost by definition, given their size and obvious impact that they would have on the economy should they get in trouble again. So now, when I bring that up and I talk about concentration, some argue very quickly that these figures show less concentration here than most places in the world, and that I should relax because of that. And my answer is, you know, the rest of the world is not the United States. And if you look at our history, I think it's been very dynamic. And in the United States, we've had a distrust of concentrated power that dates back to our beginning, and it in many ways has served us well. This wariness extends not just to income inequality, which we talk about often, but to concentration of financial power and the intended political power that flows to a select few that influence the rules of the game. And clearly that is one of the outcomes that we worry about here, and frankly, I think others are worrying about elsewhere in the world. Now, this has also produced a significant transfer of income from the real economy, the real sector, to the financial sector in the United States. You know, following the Great Depression, the financial sector share of U.S. corporate profits rose very gradually to about 20%, reaching a high of 23% in 1999. It's been around 20% most of that period. Since the end of the 90s, 1999, this share has risen to 30% in the first 5 years of this 21st century. And today, it still represents 28% of corporate of profits among the various sectors. And this has been referred to, and I think perhaps appropriately, as the financialization of our economy. And there is a view that that will continue. Now, during this period of increasing financialization, the average annual pace of real GDP growth declined in each of the last three economic recoveries, from 4.3% during the 80s to just over 2% here more recently. Now, I'm the first to admit that many factors influence economic growth, monetary policy, fiscal policy, but it's also interesting, and I think important, to raise the question of this increasing role, financial role within the economy, and still receiving less growth, especially in recovery. It may be referred to as the less for more equation. I think that's what has to be at least thought about and investigated going forward. So how do we think about this? These are the events, and now there's another element of this. Post-crisis and our concern for the SIFI, the significantly important financial institution, and the too-big-to-fail problem, we introduced a regulatory path as a solution. Not a structural, but a regulatory path as a solution. Since the financial crisis in 2008 and the enactment of Dodd-Frank, most of the regulators, most of my time, and much of the industry's attention has been focused on implementing new rules designed to control the risk profile of the largest institutions and end too big to fail. Importantly, the path chosen relies principally on what I describe as a regulatory solution rather than the structural solution. Now, there had been some structural, I can't forget that, and that is the Volcker Rule, which is objected to pretty strenuously by the industry, and it's been implemented. It does limit proprietary trading and related activities. However, more generally, there has been little appetite in the United States for structural reform, either breaking up these firms or separating their activities within the same corporate structure. It's just been very, very reluctant to even look into that. Instead, we in the United States have followed a path in which greater regulatory oversight, such as defined standards for allocating capital and liquidity within these institutions. We define those standards. New regulatory tools such as living wills, orderly liquidation, have been chosen to address the too big to fail. These are all administrative regulatory solutions to this problem. Dodd-Frank reflects then a loss of confidence in markets. Given the crisis, it's understandable, and therefore places greater weight on a regulatory solution, which also didn't do so well prior to the crisis, but ceding increased authority to individual regulators to shape the industry's activity and performance. When all this then is said, how might this path look going forward? What about the SIFIs? The U.S. banking system, I think, even with the structure of regulation that we have today, I think will continue to lead global banking for years to come. It dominates. It is part of a major economy. It's going to dominate. The largest eight banks control more than half of all industry assets now, and it's difficult to see any significant change in their size or composition in the short or immediate term. There's just no momentum for that, either up or down. For these most influential institutions, I think the subsidy has been institutionalized, that is a too big to fail subsidy and the safety net around that, and there will be powerful incentives for management to retain those benefits. They are powerful benefits. However, these benefits come with a cost to them that they've accepted of significant regulatory oversight and control, and I think this will have a new dynamic in our banking system going forward. Regulators, for their part, in an attempt to control the perceived outside risk these systemically important financial institutions pose, are promoting a one-size-fits-all solution to simplify the resolution process should it be necessary. So we're trying to simplify things so that we can manage them, right? We can observe this trend, for example, in regulators' insistence on debt being a central feature of total loss absorbing capacity, or TLAC, regardless of the bank's business model. So you will have this TLAC so you can downstream this into the, it's standard now, okay? Similarly, living wills increasingly reflect regulators' preference for a single point of entry strategy in resolution plans. It's not required, but it's certainly encouraged. Finally, the global regulatory community, us, insists on pre-weighting assets for purposes of measuring risk, anticipating problems, and the allocation of capital and liquidity. Now, this approach to safety and soundness likely will also lead to less innovation among firms, which some people may like, fewer choices for customers, which they may not like so well, and more concentrated payments and settlement system, which we're seeing right now take place. And these developments represent potential threats, I think, to the financial system as they undermine its strength and dampen long-term economic growth that comes from innovation, from increased productivity that's funded by that industry. Now, following from this path that's been chosen for the largest banks is its influence is on the development of shadow banking itself, a loosely defined group of financial firms that seek opportunities outside the financial safety net and regulatory mechanism. Now, these firms are often financed through the banking system itself or institutional investors, and in my opinion, they generally benefit the economy. However, like any exception, some will become systemic in nature. We see some of that today, and be the source, perhaps, of the next financial shock. And I don't think we can control that. But such an event cannot be easily anticipated in its effects. Therefore, I think it will depend on how it occurs, the impact it has, will depend on the broader banking industry and how well it's prepared to absorb the shock that comes from that. They will remain the key, and how well prepared they are will define the outcome. In summary, reliance on the regulatory path in pursuit of safe banking continues a long trend within the United States. It strives to internalize some of the costs of the safety net protections and to provide a means for an orderly resolution should any of these largest banks fail. The result will be an industry dramatically influenced by regulatory system itself over the market system. By the Comprehensive Capital Analysis Review, for example, CCAR, it will be influenced by the Liquidity Coverage Ratio, LCR. It will be influenced by the Net Stable Funding Ratio, NSFR, all defined by us regulators, and a common form of resolution and recovery focused on containing risk and cost to the safety net. That's the goal, simplify our job. These are worthy goals. I mean, we want safety and soundness. But it is also important to examine the emerging challenges this path presents and to identify new vulnerabilities that may follow from it. The most dominant firms in the industry might become ever more homogenized with less product innovation served to bank customers. And yes, political and regulatory influence will matter more than ever in achieving their industry's financial goals. It becomes a focal point. And all you have to do is look at the growth in the lobbying industry, and you get a sense of that. So if what I describe above is correct, then we have also raised the stakes for the regional and community banks as engines of economic growth in the United States. These institutions, already critical to job growth through the lending to small and mid-sized firms, will see increased opportunities for lending and increased pressure to merge and expand their scale footprint as they seek success in this environment. Considering regional and super-regional banks, they will continue to diversify their portfolio of services to better meet customer support demands and compete at the edges only of the SIFI's business domain. For activities such as lending to intermediate and increasingly large firms and providing trust services and asset management activities to businesses and consumers, they will work to prosper. But the regionals cannot compete successfully with the largest banks at the highest levels. The barriers to entry remain strong. The regional banks will be drawn to consolidate. Just how quickly and to what degree is less certain. The market and regulatory barriers to entry into the realm of the largest and most powerful of the banking firms are substantial and are increasing. It is also unlikely that even the largest regional firms will gain a sufficient share of payment system to be able to provide the broad investment banking services sufficient to challenge the SIFIs to any significant degree. As for the smaller community banks, they operate now in much the same way as in the past, although They have narrowed their business model to focus more on real estate and small business lending, usually secured by real estate, by the way. Using this model, they have fared relatively well in the post-crisis period, despite the effects of zero interest rates and narrow margins. On a merger-adjusted basis, given there were 1,600 mergers, community bank loans have grown by more than 8% annually in each of the last 3 years. In 2016, community bank loans grew by almost three times faster than the overall U.S. economy, and considerably faster than loans held by non-community banks, that is, the larger firms. These community banks, will most likely build on this model. It's successful, so they will build on it, focusing on growth, both in the number and size of loans under management. This narrower model provides a good source of income, but does pose concentration risk that management of them will have to be dealt with, or the FDIC will have to deal with it later, and that would not be pleasant. Finally, as with the very largest banks, regulatory oversight has taken on a greater role in defining how regional and community banks will operate in the future, and thus their success will depend to a significant degree on how regulators perform this expanding role, how they choose to perform this expanding role. The one phrase going around Washington these days is personnel is policy, and I think this will be a test. Given the higher stakes for maintaining growth and providing resiliency through future business cycles, this expanded regulatory framework will most certainly influence success for banking in the decades to come. So let me conclude with the point that Jan started with. I will emphasize that the balance in the forces of change has shifted, with greater reliance on an administered regulatory system and less on market forces. As this process has unfolded, there has been too little discussion among industry participants and policymakers about the role of structure on industry performance, on innovation, and long-term economic growth. Issues regarding bank and financial concentration, the further financialization of our economy, and the amalgamation of our investment banking industry deserve our attention, especially now in good times when we can focus on it without panic. There simply has been too little discussion about long-run effects on the banking industry and the real economy of the regulatory path chosen after the financial crisis. We need to take a step back. We need to take a breath and take a look. To be sure, there has been some renewed discussion of structural reforms, such as the return to Glass-Steagall. I'm not sure where that will go. But there are other alternatives, including greater separation of activities within the holding company, which I have recently suggested. Either in combination with structural changes or by itself, we should also consider better balancing the advantages the largest firms receive from the safety net and the increasing need that they hold capital to absorb those shocks that are inevitably going to occur. Under the right organizational model, we might finally be able to legitimately reduce regulation, turn back the market with greater confidence, and promote higher levels of sustainable economic growth. I actually released the proposal some time ago. I don't know if you've seen it. We have copies of it here. And basically, it's not a new idea. It reinvigorates, enriches, I like to say, the bank holding company model, where you separate out the traditional commercial banking with the safety net from the more, shall we say, adventurous investment trading companies, put them separate. It involves tracking shares, which you see in commercial firms today when they have their old company and their more risky new endeavors. It allows then for the risk to be identified, the market to price it, the safety to be identified and the market to price it, and yet have a common ownership so that you can, in fact, shall we say, take advantage of the synergies of commercial banking and investment banking. I think this needs consideration today, for the future, or we then make a conscious decision to continue down a very heavily regulated path. So I'm going to end with those comments. We have, I think, time for questions.